Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everybody, what's up? Welcome back to the show. Today we're talking about Volvo. This is our first part, one of three parts on Volvo's history. This one is a really good one, talking about a lot of cool cars, pronouncing a lot of Swedish names.
Of Swedish names.
But we're going to learn a lot along the way, and I promise you guys are going to love this one. So let's just get right into it. It's Volvo Part 1. Sweden, 1914. In the fog of World War I, the land of the Midnight Sun was finding it difficult to maintain its neutrality while trading with both the Entente and Central Powers. At the time, Sweden's sole car manufacturer, Scania Vabis, only made ultra-high-end luxury cars like the 3S Phaeton and the Type 3 Limousine, which had absolute necessities like a top hat holder on the roof. But the uncertainty of the war that engulfed Sweden's neighbors took a toll on domestic luxury car sales, and Scania Vabis turned to producing trucks for the Swedish army. This left a hole in the market that was being filled exclusively by imported cars. The Swedish Association of Engineers and Architects saw this as a potential problem and approached a ball bearing company called Svenska Kullagerfabriken, or SKF, to conduct an independent study on the feasibility of a new, all-Swedish car company. At the time, other ball bearing companies were investing heavily in automobiles, which relied on the bearings to drive smoothly. The more cars sold meant more bearings, and if the bearing company had a partial stake in a car maker, that meant one less part to outsource. It was a mutually beneficial relationship, and one Swede understood just how beneficial it could be. How did a ball bearing company spawn one of the safest and most reliable car companies in the world? Why did one of their engineers give a patent away for free? And how did this company continue to innovate for nearly 100 years? This week on Pass Gas, it's part one of our three-part history on Volvo.
Volvo?
Every episode I do the intro and then
you look at I feel panic.
I'm sorry.
Honestly, I was trying to like every molecule in me was just holding back the Swedish chef from the Muppets. I know he's a caricature.
He's a caricature. We're going to try to steer away from him during this series.
We're doing a great job so far.
Yeah. So far, only one mention
in the first
minute. Not an impression.
Not an impression. I didn't do an impression.
Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody.
Also, when Nolan's looking over, he just wants you to say, nice job.
Yeah. No, nice. I don't know. I just look. I do. I do look over at Joe. I'm like, Joe's got to do something funny now. Like, maybe I should start looking at Bart across the table. I don't know. But welcome back to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes, and Bart is giving me two middle fingers.
That's pretty funny, though.
Pretty good. Yeah. It is a visual gag. But yes, across from me, the aforementioned and affable Bart Brat Bidlingmeyer.
Yeah. I just got a notification that I have a new email account.
Don't say your email account unless you want to be inundated.
No, I'm not going to say the whole thing, but they spelled my first name, B-R-A-T.
Brat. Yeah. Having a brat summer this year for Bart. And you got Joe Weber. What's up, dude?
It's brat year for Joe. I don't know what that means, but...
Me either.
I do like that album.
It's good.
You're not super into it. Max isn't super into it, but I... you know, a lot of great albums came out last year.
It was a heavy year. Yeah.
Heavy year. I got this one on vinyl.
Oh wow. You got the vinyl. So you really like it.
It's like nice colored white disc. It's really good.
Look,
ever since me and Chloe have been going out, and now that we are married, you know, I'm getting into the pop music side of music. You know, before we were dating, I was mostly just all listening Deftones. To metal. Deftones, Mastodon, Meshuggah, Gojira. That's my big four.
Yeah.
But you know, now that I'm married, and I don't know, I just find myself less
picky.
Less picky for sure. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, now I listen to a lot of I've gotten a lot into Sturgill Simpson.
Oh, yeah.
He's a country folk guy.
He is breaching the gap.
Yeah. Well, he has a rock album.
Yeah.
It's there's no slide guitar on it. I don't really like the slide guitar sound. That's why I never really got into the country.
You were just listening to
some Jeff Beck. Yeah.
What is that song? Night walking,
sleepwalking.
Yeah. That's a great song.
That's from when I was in high school,
the 40s. Having a baby changes what your Spotify algorithm does. But I find myself, there's a playlist called Kid Songs That Aren't Annoying, which is great. It's got My Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. But also,
are they sung by a kid's choir, or are these just songs Woody Guthrie. Yeah. All right, good.
But also instrumental versions, string quartet versions of pop songs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. Cool. It was just, you plug into your phone and your Spotify starts going. So in the morning, it just started playing, and Thunderstruck by a band called Two Cellos came on. And it was badass.
Yeah.
It was so cool. I didn't think it would. You've heard it before?
I have heard this song. It's awesome. I know the band, and they're awesome. I mean, the band.
So shout out to Two Cellos.
Duo.
You guys are killing it.
I came into the kitchen.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's all right. And my son had put on Zach Bryan on the record player.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, that's all right. And the record player is off limits, but he was kind of
sensitive equipment.
I'm gonna listen to this. And he put it on. It was cool. And then I see him at the table, and he's like, just with this wry smile on his face.
What? How old is your son now?
Six.
Six. Okay. I mean, when I was his age, my mom also kept her record player. I mean, and we used to listen to a lot of REM. I draw on Don't Go Back to Rockville on the record player.
It's fun when they start. On the other side of that, we have the Amazon, they have an Echo Dot in the room. So, sometimes they'll put stuff on.
Mm-hmm.
Get Your Jammies On is a popular one around
get
bedtime.
Get your jammies on, motherfucker.
Well, other than the curse, it's like, come on. Get your jammies on. Dun, dun, dun. It's
no
got
way.
This sick ass bass
line. Hilarious.
Get your jammies on. But on the other side of that, we have another Amazon in the kitchen with the little screen. I forget what they're all called.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, but it'll be recently played, kind of like, do you want to continue listening to this? And it's recently played. Poop, 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 poop. Bye. Or from the album, Poop Man in Fartland. So that's the other end of kids being able to ask Alexa for music.
You know, it's a really great concept album. I keep going, see where the story goes.
Yeah. A great through line. Last vinyl story, I swear, before we jump into this. One of the only things that stopped Wyatt from crying, when he was a real tiny guy, very cocky, hard to handle. We would put a record on and he would look at the record. And so whenever we want him to just calm down and zen out, I put a record on and just let him watch it.
Yeah.
And since I right before the baby came, I was I'm gonna splurge. I used to DJ. I got scratching needles. I have a fader, a mixer in the middle, and two Technique 1200s.
Mm-hmm.
And I put on my most beat up record. And I let him just grab the record, and
that's pretty good.
And he was I was kind of moving his hand back and forth, and he was scratching, and Emily thought it was so funny.
It is pretty good.
DJ Wyatt in the house, dude.
Yeah.
Quiet Wyatt.
Things your
dude.
Kids should be doing before one.
Yeah, he's gonna be
responding to his name, lifting his head, scratching beats.
Yeah.
He's going to be the next DJ Shadow, dude.
Yeah. Quiet Wyatt or Riot Wyatt when he's Wyatt going Riot. Crazy. Yeah.
Wyatt Riot. That's pretty good, dude. All right.
Wyatt da baby. Weber.
That was my air horn. Wasn't that good?
It's all right. You have some people have higher air horns than others.
Yeah. Assar Gabrielsson was born in 1891 in Korsberg, Sweden, 230 kilometers from Gothenburg. So like 4 miles.
Audrey had the miles there, and I think I accidentally did the check mark to like get rid of the note. So,
it's fine. It's like 100. It's like 130 miles.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. I don't know where Gothenburg is, so I have no point of reference for distance.
It's on the west coast of Sweden.
Mm. Mr. Ass graduated from the Stockholm School of Economics in 1911 and moved to Gothenburg on Sweden's west coast. Nice job, Joe, to work for SKF as a ball bearing salesman shortly after. Now, if you can't remember SKF, that is Svenska Kullagerfabriken. After transferring to Paris to work as a managing director for one of SKF's subsidiaries, Gabrielsson observed SKF's competitors buddying up with car makers. He typed up his findings and presented a proposal to SKF and their managing director, Bjorn Pritz, and CEO Axel Karlander.
These are the most Swedish names, but they're also like badass Swedish
Axel
names.
Axel Karlander,
right?
Was like born to be in the car business.
Yeah. Gabrielsson had an ingenious idea. Start a car company under the SKF umbrella. If put into motion, the plan would benefit SKF immensely, as they could sell more bearings and develop new bearings. Perhaps more importantly, it also helped Sweden's faltering post-war economy and give the country a badly needed domestic car brand.
I love the idea of being an R&D at a ball bearing company. Being like, got a new one. It's bigger. Oh, guys, guess what? A new ball bearing. This one's smaller. still a ball.
Well, I think we did an episode, maybe it was part of the Dodge series, where ball bearings didn't have shields back then or something. And then like the shielded ball bearing was a huge innovation for this time because it kept dirt out.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Alas, Karlander didn't buy into Asser's plan. In his and the board members' eyes, SKF should focus on ball bearings and ball bearings alone. Gabrielsson didn't take this rejection sitting down, though. He knew there's potential for a Swedish-made car, and he was willing to put his own money down to prove it.
On July 25th, 1924, Assar Gabrielsson met his old friend Gustav Larsson at the Sturhof Brasserie in Stockholm for a meal and a chat.
Mmm.
Two had met working at SKF years earlier when Larsson had engineered the ball bearings that Gabrielsson sold.
Gotcha.
Since then, Gustav had left the company to work for White and Pop, which is not a pimple company.
It's a bad business to be in.
But an engine and gearbox manufacturer in Great Britain, where he had learned the ins and outs of machining and industrial engine manufacturing. By the time the two had met again, Gustav was back in Stockholm working as a technical director for AB Galco, an industrial manufacturing company. Over the course of the meal, Assar laid out his plan to build 10 working prototypes of an all-Swedish car using his own money. He would then use these cars to convince SKF to start manufacturing the models.
Man, he must have been getting paid pretty well to build 10 prototypes.
Yeah, or he's just like super into the idea and like going in crazy debt. Like when they made Mall Rats, you know? Or Clerks.
Exactly like
Clerks.
That.
No. What was that guy's name?
Kevin Smith.
Yeah. Kevin Smith took out like 7 credit cards and maxed them out to make Clerks, and somehow it paid off.
Here we are. Also, everybody, whenever we're doing like a story on some epic company, it's always, and this person use their own money, you know, and like how many things would we not have if, you know, people didn't believe in themselves.
Yeah.
Stupid suits saying no. Come on.
So needless to say, this was a huge financial gamble. Assar was fronting all the money and Gustav, who would be in charge of the engineering and industrial plans, wouldn't get paid unless they sold more than 100 cars.
I'm guessing Gustav was also like, can we make 100?
Yeah.
I know you said 10, but can we just make 100? Yeah. Just in case?
Nevertheless, the two came to an agreement. Even though the official written contract wouldn't be signed for another year, this moment could be considered the spiritual birth of Volvo.
Hmm.
The name was there from the beginning, actually before the beginning. Volvo was the name of a series of ball bearings that SKF developed to sell to the U.S. all the way back in 1915, spearheaded by Bjorn Prytz. The name Volvo comes from the Latin word volvere, which means I roll or I turn, fitting, very fitting for a ball bearing company.
It's just funny to name your product after the verb that it does.
Yeah.
Your product.
Yeah. It was back. This is the early days of naming things.
Yeah.
And we ran the out of them quick.
The new SKF I-Turn. I mean, they were kind of ahead of the game there a little bit, actually. Yeah.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
Now back to the show.
The name Volvo had been trademarked by SKF, but the project never came to fruition.
There's this guy I knew in high school, Andrew, who always had like those sarcastic, funny, like graphic t-shirts that were really big in the mid to early 2000s. He had one that said, I pooed on it.
Like
silhouette of a man on a toilet.
Well, the other days, my kids were like using things in the car as phones.
Yeah.
And my son was like, Ivy, I have an Apple phone. And I was like, that was really good.
That's pretty good. Kids got chops.
Tell your mom that when we get home.
Take him down to Groundlings or whatever.
Well, that's more character.
Oh. Yeah.
He
was doing,
I don't know, man. Let's go.
Speaking of naming things after, you know, the literal thing,
mm-hmm.
there are, you know, like I got a friend named George Butcher. There's Barber. You know, people have Barber as a last name.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that when people didn't have last names, it was like, you know, the guy who cuts up the meat. You know, what's his name? Like Frank Butcher?
And it stuck.
Yeah.
That's great.
The Volvo badge we know today, a circle with an arrow pointing out the top right side, has also been around since the beginning. It's not the symbol for the male gender or the Roman god Mars, as many people think.
Oh.
The badge is actually derived from the ancient alchemy symbol for iron.
Huh.
This represents the strength and resilience of Swedish steel.
Interesting.
If I can, I just wanted to double check this before I brought it up because I wasn't sure if it, but you're saying like people with their names or naming things what they are. There was a study done that found, they were looking at dentists. They found 482 dentists named Dennis, compared to 257 named Walter and 270 named Jerry. So those were the next two most common names under Dennis. And so it's a statistically significant, like more likelihood that if your name is, that there are, the name Dennis has a correlation to becoming a dentist.
How many of them are menaces?
They're all dentists, so all of them. Just like really anti-dentist stance.
Yeah, an anti-dentite.
Gustav Larsson and designer Jan G. Smith. Very not Swedish sounding last name.
It's Jan. Come on.
Jan. Smith, though,
I know, but
who had just returned from working with automakers in the U.S., began designing the first Volvo car in late 1924. The work was done quietly. All invoices for the design and engineering were sent directly to Astor's home address, and the only one who knew about the project at SKF was managing director Pritz, who condoned it as long as it didn't interfere with Asar's day-to-day duties.
Quietly there is a metaphor. I mean, it was probably pretty loud.
Probably was the car. Yeah.
They're banging on sheet metal,
It's in secret.
Asser and Gustav set up their Skunk Works operation at AB Galco in Stockholm so Gustav could keep an eye on it while working his normal job. The design team ran through many different sketches before landing on the final blueprint. It had to do a few things very well before they considered it ready. Reliably endure the harsh Swedish terrain with its mud, snow, potholes, steep hills, etc. And keep the driver and passengers safe.
Safe, okay.
That last part was especially important, as it became one of the most enduring themes of Volvo throughout its entire history. The ethos was there from day one. Asser Gabrielsson was quoted a year after the company was founded, saying, quote, "Cars are driven by people. The guiding principle behind everything we make at Volvo, therefore, is and must remain safety." Wow, so they were way ahead of the curve there.
Yeah. Whereas Ford was quoted by saying, "Who gives a shit?"
Yeah. By June of 1926, they had a working prototype. Internally, the first 10 prototypes were referred to as the Jakob because they were finished on July 25th, known as Jakob's Name Day, which is a religious thing.
It's the feast of Saint Jakob. Every saint has a name day. Oh. Jakob.
I didn't know that.
And every saint has their name day, which I didn't know before this either. Dude, I was
For explaining that to me, a thing you didn't know until you just read that.
I'm saying that for the cameras. Okay. I obviously wrote that note.
Gotcha.
We were walking around the Autry Museum, and there was like a big, surrealist painting of Jesus. It was like pretty scary. And there's
underrated
like,
museum, if I can say
it's
it.
Awesome. It's awesome. I love the Autry Museum. And it was so free up until like 2 days ago.
Yeah.
But, this little like 2 or 3 year old girl was asking the funniest questions to her mom about Jesus. Yeah. And she was like, "Who's that?" And mom's like, "That's Jesus." And she goes, "That's not a baby." I was like, "No, I mean the baby grew up."
Yeah.
And the girl's like, "But doesn't Jesus get born every year on December 25th? And the mom had to keep explaining, but it was like every single question was so funny.
That's hilarious. Production versions of this car were called the Oppenwagen 4, or Open Carriage 4-Cylinder, aka the OV4, and were cobbled together with parts ordered from other parts of Europe and the United States. One of the only parts that was actually Swedish was its 1.9-liter side-valve 4-cylinder, making a whopping 28 horsepower and 74 foot-pounds of torque, which was manufactured by SKF subsidiary Pentavirken.
I'd be willing to guess that the ball bearings were also Swedish.
I would guess so too. Things got off to a rocky start. The first prototype rolled out of the factory with the differential installed backwards. So it had one short forward gear and 3 reverse gears. The mistake, thankfully, only took 10 minutes to fix. Another unfortunate mishap occurred when the prototype was driving from Stockholm to Gothenburg and was involved in a collision with another car. But there was a silver lining. The other car, which was American, sustained major damage, while the Jakob barely had a scratch. The accident was unfortunate, but it reinforced the idea that safety was Volvo's utmost priority.
It's got to be like the only other car on the road at the time.
Yeah. Hey, you got your safety in my unsafe. You got your unsafe in my safety. It's those old Reese's. Yeah. Okay.
In August of 1926, Asser and Larsson drove the Jakob prototype to SKF themselves to present their final proposal. The company that had rejected his initial offer was finally convinced and had a new contract drawn up. Essentially, Asser sold his project plans and prototypes to SKF and was reimbursed for all the capital he had funneled into the project. Larsson was finally compensated as well.
Dude, working on spec for a car? That's crazy.
Asser then stepped down as sales manager for SKF to be president of Volvo AB. A few months later, Gustav Larsson was named vice president and technical director of Volvo after fulfilling his final obligations to Galco. The two had achieved what they had set out to do. Create a Swedish car company with the emphasis on safety, durability, reliability, and innovation.
Gabrielsson and Larsson set up shop in a factory on the outskirts of Gothenburg that had been abandoned by SKF. Here they started churning out OV4 models for sale to the public. Priced at 4,800 Swedish kroners, or $465 US, or about $8,000 nowadays, OV4 was way more approachable to the general public than the more upmarket Scania Vabis models. Plus, it was noticeably more durable and utilitarian than anything on Swedish roads at the time.
They really do look like, I don't know how to say it right, but a well-made, rugged, sturdy Model T car.
Yeah.
You know, like they, you a look stout. At it. Yeah, it's stout.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
In their first fiscal year, Volvo had 60 workers assembling 5 cars a week at their Gothenburg plant. So unfortunately, their initial sales were dismal. This was mainly due to their first model being a cabriolet, which car buyers at the time were apprehensive about buying thanks to the harsh Swedish elements.
It is like an oversight. Yeah?
Yeah, it's a strange move.
Yeah. Put a roof on it.
How far in did we get?
Oh, shit.
We're like halfway through.
All right.
Yeah. I'll allow
so,
it.
Because of that, Volvo recalibrated and started offering a covered version of the OV4 called the PV4 in the summer of 1927. Sales of the PV4 were much better, but still not great. All in all, Volvo sold 302 OV4s and 694 PVs. Assar needed to think of something quick or else his dream company would go under, like the countless automaker startups before him.
But none since.
But his solution? Look backwards and be even more utilitarian.
You know, it's funny. I mean, over on Big Three, we've talked about this a lot. Like, crossovers all look the same. Like, this decade of design is like pretty boring because everything just has the same kind of blobbish look to it.
Yeah.
But then you look at cars like the PV4 and the OV4, and they look exactly the same as like all the other cars from that time. Yeah, anytime we're in this period of time on past gas, it's like all these cars look like this.
Yeah.
But it's also because it's the first period of time.
Yeah.
For this. You know, like,
I know.
Okay.
But I'm just saying, like, you know, it's same as it ever was. 100 years later, it's the same thing.
Yeah. And it's funny to think, like,
but without an excuse. Like, the excuse is we could do anything we want.
Well,
now.
The excuse being that, like, the shapes that we see now are, like, aerodynamically very efficient and also safe, crash, like, safety wise. But yeah, that. 2030s,
I hear what you're saying.
If we're still around by then, I'd like to see some new shit. Thank you. All right.
And period.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie, and one thing I've learned is that you buy a house, but you make it a home. Because with every fix, update, and renovation, it becomes a little more your own. So you need all your jobs done well. For nearly 30 years, Angie has helped millions of homeowners hire skilled pros for the projects that matter, from plumbing to electrical, roof repair to deck upgrades. So leave it to the pros who will get your jobs done well. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now back to the show.
The next few years at Volvo saw the release of their first truck series, the LV. This design actually predated the OD4's design and shared many components with it, including the 1.9-liter side valve four-cylinder. The initial run of 500 trucks sold out immediately, a promising sign after the slow sales of its older siblings. Guys were using their tax returns to buy wheels for it.
Haul those lingonberries.
The next year, Volvo engineers went all in on bolstering the LV. The result was the LV Series 2, which featured strengthened components, wider axles, a 4-speed gearbox, and icing on the Silvia Caca, a 6-cylinder option. I'm assuming that means cake.
I had to Google most popular Swedish cakes for that joke.
This truck also was designed, which I don't think hurt its sales. Like, it has a cooler front end.
Yeah.
It's got a fun looking grill. It's got more stylish lines. It may be more utilitarian, but it's starting to look better.
I mean, it
too.
Definitely just, yeah, it looks very truck, early truck like. Customers were saying that the dinky 28 horsepower four cylinder wasn't enough for the truck, and Volvo listened. They added a new 3-liter Pentavirken inline six cylinder as an option for the truck called the LV60. The inline six made double the horsepower of the four cylinder, but engineers knew they could do even better. They kept tinkering. And by 1932, they had bumped up the displacement to 3.7 liters and up the output to 65 horsepower. Volvo really hit the nail on the head with the LV60, and a version of this truck sold for the next 20 years. The LV60's success helped finance other operations at the company and allowed engineers to innovate. In a way, the LV60's legacy lives on today. Volvo Trucking is a huge business, although it's a separate entity from the consumer car division.
Just some disclosure for this. I wrote this script in the next one, and the amount of subsidiaries that Volvo has is crazy. So just a overall note, we're focusing on just the cars. If anyone wants to get crazy in the comments and be like, well, what about the trucking business? What about the aero business? Blah, 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 blah.
Gotcha. Thanks for the disclaimer. With the success of the inline six powered truck, Assar and Gustav figured people would like a car powered by the same engine and introduced the upmarket PV650 series, or Personenwagen, in 1929. It provided much more oomph for getting around tricky Swedish terrain and had the added luxury of a plush interior. It was a breakout success in the luxury car market and even saw fleet usage as a taxi for many years. The PV line was so successful that Volvo was able to raise enough capital to buy the controlling stake of their engine manufacturer, Pentavirken. Something just occurred to me. How did people in the early years of the automobile clean their cars? Because I'm thinking like, okay, you're driving your car on the farm or whatever. You might get muddy boots, bring that mud into your car. Maybe you got some carpet, you got plush seats. How are you going to clean that? There's no car cleaning like soaps and stuff.
They probably just killed a bunch of minks and then made new formats.
Gotcha. Yeah, maybe. But, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, I think if you had a car that you're like one of the trucks that you'd use on the farm, I think one, you'd care less about what you dragged inside
of it. That's true.
If you have a luxury car like this, you probably have people to like take out the.
I do want to know who like the Larry Casilla of that time was, where it's like, you're going to want to use that mink. You're going to want to take that whole mink carcass and just wipe down your dash.
Wasn't there a Ford that they rushed where they used like lice infested horsehair for the seat?
The straw that was inside the seats.
It was like Spanish moss.
Yeah, Spanish moss. Yes.
Like a bunch of bugs love to live in Spanish moss, and they stuffed the seats with it.
Yeah.
It also had like a wooden frame or something where like termites were in the frame.
That's pretty funny, man.
Around this time, the top brass at Volvo saw that other manufacturers were using racing to show how reliable and strong their cars were. Although it went against the ethos of safety first, Volvo entered into several speed and endurance races. Volvo models won races across Sweden and finished first in an endurance race from Leningrad, which is St. Petersburg now, to Moscow. Later, a Volvo won rallies in Monte Carlo and Argentina. The race wins were nice, but when you're doing well, you have a big target on your back. It wasn't long before other car manufacturers started slinging mud. Chevy, who had a plant in Stockholm, took a shot at Volvo by placing an ad in the local newspaper claiming Volvo didn't manufacture a Swedish product and that their cars were, quote, kit-made, implying Volvo didn't make their parts and outsourced everything. That's such a weird thing as a foreign manufacturer to be like,
well... And, you know,
it still happens today.
I can see like Toyota putting out an ad where it's like, Ford, built American, actually more like built out in Mexico, whereas our stuff's built in the U.S. Like I could totally see them doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. You think Toyota would do that though?
I mean, car manufacturers today who are based overseas hype up their American manufacturing. Mm-hmm.
They do have like the Tacoma in the flag, the flag overlay on the Tacoma or Tundra. That is funny. Volvo responded to Chevy by doing an internal audit, which found that 90% of their parts were Swedish made. This prompted them to take out an ad in the same newspaper calling themselves, quote, the Swedish cars.
I will say this is probably like also after this, someone got fired from Chevrolet Sweden.
You think so?
Yeah. What did you do, man? What you did? Now they're the Swedish car.
Come on, Sven.
Come on, Sven.
In 1931, Volvo introduced a freewheel in their cars, which let the gearbox temporarily disengage from the drive shaft. This allowed the car to cruise without having to throttle and resulted in 20% better fuel economy.
Okay.
So it got 2 miles to the gallon.
In 1933, Volvo debuted the PV653 and PV654. Many innovations went into making these cars a comfortable ride. The firewall had sound insulation, the engine mounts had rubber gaskets, and the carburetor had an air intake silencer.
Strange.
It's weird that, like, intake sound isn't that much that you would...
Yeah. By 1935, Volvo was employing 1,115 workers at their Gothenburg plant, nearly 14 times the number of employees from hardly a decade earlier. Work started on their third passenger car, the PV36, which would go on to be called the Carioca, named after a South American dance. The Carioca was Volvo's first big jump into the modern streamlined era. The car was designed by Ivan Ornberg, who had spent his whole career in the U.S. working for American car manufacturers. Ivan was brought in to breathe new life into Volvo's design team, which were still stuck in the 1920s. Ivan took inspiration from cars like the Chrysler Airflow. The Carioca featured a more rounded design, a split windshield, and covered rear wheels, which helped gas mileage. It was powered by the tried-but-true 3.7-liter Pentavögen V6, which now made 86 horsepower. The PV36 was considered a luxury car, but another version of the car, called the P51, was Volvo's first foray into economy cars. It was basically a simplified version of the Carioca with no split windshield, no armrests, one windshield wiper, and non-covered rear wheels. The P51 was almost 400 pounds lighter than the P36, and with the upgraded V6, it was also much faster. It was priced at a meager 5,800 Swedish kronor, which was $534 US or just under 12 grand today. This car and its successor, the PV52, did record sales for Volvo. And by 1937, the 25,000th Volvo rolled off the factory floor in Gothenburg.
The 52 looks like such a gangster car. Like if you made a Beetle into a gangster car.
Oh, yeah. I see that. Volvo continued to release variants of the PV until Hitler invaded Poland in 1939, officially kicking off World War II. The company was working on an entirely new passenger car until... fuel, rubber, and metal shortages, and a nationwide ban put a stop to private motoring. But that didn't mean that Volvo stopped innovating. There wasn't much petrol to be had, but coal was abundant. So Volvo engineers developed an engine that ran off charcoal by turning it into combustible gas. What? Unfortunately, the other material shortages and the government ban prevented this engine from seeing the light of day. Volvo, ever resourceful, found a way to keep the business running during this time by manufacturing military vehicles. In 1942, they used the capital they had raised by making army vehicles to purchase a controlling stake in Svenska Flygmotor, which was later renamed Volvo Aero, and Köpings Mekaniska Verkstad, a company that manufactured gearboxes for their cars.
Huh. Swedish is kind of like Dutch, where it sounds like someone just slurring an English word a little bit.
Yeah. During the war, or are we slurring Dutch? During the war, Volvo engineers...
For those just listening, Joe's head's exploded.
It exploded.
Yeah, like that's in what scanners.
During the war, Volvo engineers somehow found time to develop an entirely new car, the PV444, the 444. This streamlined coupe featured more innovations by Volvo engineers, including a unibody construction and laminated glass. Safety glass had been around since 1874, but this was the first time shatterproof glass was installed in a car. Volvo's version had two panes with a layer of resin sandwiched in between them to prevent shards of glass from flying all over and slicing your dang penis off.
Whoa, Nolan. Dude, kids listen to this.
Hey. You want safety, right?
And you want to use anatomically correct words.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. No, this wasn't vulgar. I'm sick of you guys being so vulgar.
Design for the PV 444 was done by 1944. When the prototype was unveiled to the car-starved Swedes, they ate it up like some Sylvia Kaka. The initial response was overwhelmingly positive for the small coupe, but Volvo had to wait until the war was over to start manufacturing. Scarce resources, material rationing, and the government ban on civilian motoring all cleared up in time for Volvo to roll the first versions off the factory floor in 1947. Even though the design was already outdated by the time production began, the PV earned respect by being scrappy and capable on harsh terrain. Up until this point, Volvo had the lion's share of the Swedish domestic car market and was relatively unchallenged in their sector. However, this was all about to change as an old name was about to be resurrected as a branch of the Svenska Aeroplan Aktiebolaget, a.k.a. Saab. And that name was Scania.
So the naming conventions for Volvo at the time was the series, actually still up until I think the 90s or something. The series, so like series four. The second number was the amount of cylinders.
Okay.
So four cylinders.
Okay.
And the third number was the doors.
The doors.
So like a hatchback would be like 445.
Yeah, but this 444.
Yeah.
The one I'm looking at has two doors.
Oh. Then never mind at all.
I just look at the same.
Maybe seats?
Maybe seats, yes. Maybe seats. Seats. Seats is what I meant.
Yeah, that's what you meant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew that's what you meant. Scania had been busy Scania had been busy making military vehicles ever since the First World War. So they were never big competition for Volvo. Remember, the void they left in the market was the reason Volvo became a company in the first place. But now that the world was at relative peace and government contracts are drying up, Scania started using their vast infrastructure to sell imported civilian vehicles like Willys Jeeps and Volkswagen Beetles. These affordable cars sold incredibly well and boosted Scania's consumer car market share to over 40% in Sweden. Oh, that's big.
That's huge.
Over on the industrial truck side, they were dominating the market with a 70% share. Volvo felt threatened, but instead of lashing out or digging their heels in, the company did something they had done before to great success. Listen to their customers. If customers were saying that the PV444 had outdated looks, then Volvo was going to update the looks of their cars. Italian styling, made famous by design houses like Bertone, Pininfarina, and Vignale, were popular at the time. The car designs coming out of Italy post-World War II were avant-garde, masculine yet feminine at the same time. The sleek and powerful-looking roadsters tugged on the heartstrings of anyone lucky enough to witness one spiritedly drive past. These Italian heartbreakers were commonly featured in movies at the time as well, and Volvo thought if they could get one of their cars on the big screen, that might give them enough of a boost to reclaim some of Scania's market share. No one knew this better than Volvo designer Jan Wilsgaard. He imagined the future of Volvo design as marrying romantic Italian design with Swedish practicality. Wilsgaard let this simple, brilliant mentality inspire the new class of Volvo. The first model to feature the new Italian-inspired design was the 1956 P1900.
So that means it's a one-cylinder with nine seats.
No.
And
they switched naming conventions at this point to just be like,
all right,
1.9 liter.
I got it. So that's a 1.9.
Yeah.
Great. See this? Thank you, Jim.
The P1900 was a small roadster inspired by the Chevrolet Corvette. The P1900 featured innovations like puncture-proof tires and was built on a tubular steel chassis.
Tubular, dude. That's tubular.
Wow. Wrapped.
Have you seen this chassis, dude? It's tubular.
It also had a fiberglass body. But unlike the 225 horsepower Corvette, the 1900 featured the 1.4 liter four-cylinder from the PV444. Which delivered 70 horsepower on the road via a three-speed manual. The first 19 units were made in California by boat manufacturer Glassbar. That's crazy. Only 68 of these cars were ever made, and while they barely had an impact on the sales front, the car let Volvo decision makers know they were on the right track.
Take a look at this car. It's exactly kind of what...
Oh.
Right? It looks like a Corvette.
It's very Corvette-like. Yeah, very first-gen Corvette.
Look at how kinda deep ugly the grill is.
Yeah, it's ugly.
My think those headlights, they're, again, they're Volvo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can still look at it and see where it came from.
That's.
I also think that's funny that we're like, oh yeah, round headlights. Kind of like how every other car had round headlights back then.
The 50s were a decade of big change for Volvo. In 1952, founder and visionary leader Gustav Larsson retired. Gustav had been an important figure in nearly every decision made at the company since its inception. He remained on board as a consultant, but it was up to innovators like Gabrielsson and Niels Bohlin to lead Volvo into the post-war era. The new leadership stepped up to the plate, and the latter part of the 1950s would prove to be Volvo's most successful era yet. They started with an innovation that you can find in every car sold these days, the three-point safety belt. In 1956, Volvo engineers Niels Bohlin was working on a device that would be safer and more comfortable than a lap belt, which we also keep in airplanes still. Bohlin's device protected the upper half of the body, which a lap belt didn't, and retracted to be out of sight when not needed. Niels decided to share the patent and make the plans free to use by any other company. This selfless decision has saved millions of lives since these belts first became standard in Volvo's and soon every other manufacturer. The very first car to feature three-point belts as standard was the Volvo Amazon. Built on the underpinnings of the PV444, the Amazon, or 120 series as it would go on to be called, was inspired by American cars and featured pontoon styling. While it wasn't the fastest or sexiest car out there, even though it was still pretty hot, it was reliable and sold insanely well.
And its mom said it was very good looking. And why doesn't it have a girlfriend?
So more versions of this car would go on to sell almost 10,000 times more than the P1900 during its 14-year production run. This might be the most important car Volvo's ever made, as it exposed many different countries to the name Volvo. It made the badge synonymous with reliability, another favorable characteristic the company could add to their safe, innovative, and rugged reputation. I mean, dude, the Amazon and the P1800, I think, are like some of the sickest Volvos ever made. And I've seen so many, not so many, but you can see a lot of builds online where people take the, they're like the Swedish, they don't look exactly like it, but like the Swedish Datsun 510.
Yeah.
Where it's like, here's this little boxy little car. Let's put a badass engine in it and take it racing.
Dude.
Yeah.
LS swapped Amazon. That's so sick. Cool. Look at that thing.
Super cool. I used to have like a rotating, lineup of wallpapers on my car that I had found. And one of them was like an Amazon that was like sliding on this dirt road, throwing up a big rooster tail and stuff. And ever since then, I'm like, I would love to drive one of those someday. They're very cool cars. The end of the 1950s would see the other half of the founding team retire. Assar Gabrielsson, the man who had grown Volvo from a little seed of an idea to a fully realized entity, decided to hang up his hat after more than 30 years in the same position.
Oddly, it was on the top hat holder.
Yeah, nice. Gabrielsson had seen the company through the most challenging of times, including a war that encompassed most of Europe, and had come out on the other side stronger than ever. Cars were getting better, sleeker, and more powerful, and it was up to the next leader to bring Volvo into a new age. But for a company as innovative as Volvo, they wouldn't be trying to catch up to current trends. They would be making them. Coming up next time, hot off the success of the Amazon, Volvo was flush with cash and eager to develop something sexier than the outdated bookish wagon. Enter the Volvo P1800. Smaller, sportier, and just as reliable, this car won over a crucial audience with a lot of spending power. Americans. And just like the cars it was copying, it became a hero on the big screen. And that's where we'll pick up in our next episode.
You guys excited for part
two?
Yeah,
I can't wait. It's an exciting era in design.
Is that
for cars in general? Have you guys thought about that we had the Volvo Amazon? But now Volvo is selling trucks to Amazon.
Oh, circle. Time's a flat circle. no, the show that it was in was the original The Saint with Roger Moore.
So good.
Roger Moore.
And he liked it so much that he just bought a couple of them for his normal day-to-day life. That's
cool. I got to have a couple cars. You buy one car, but I'd rather have a couple of these cars.
I'm a car guy. I like a couple of different cars.
All right. Joe, we got some listener mail.
This is from Nick. Hey, Gassers, I've been binging your show while I work and drive. I'm currently on number 142, so I've still got plenty of episodes left, and I love the banter mixed with history of cars and related stories. Thanks for putting in the hard work so I can ignore all my problems for multiple hours a day.
That's why we're here.
You should do what I do, just ignore them 24/7.
He's not going to hear this one for like months then.
Yeah. I'm currently doing some construction for some of the family and thought it would be cool to get an episode on the dynasty. I've been told about some of the non-automotive R&D they do, and it's incredible. If you're interested, I could even reach out to the contact I have, who is a family member, and see if they're interested in cahooting with Big Donut. Keep juicing the slugs back, Nick.
Maybe we'll bleep the family he's doing some construction for.
Yeah, I don't want to get you fired or anything.
Yeah, dude, I appreciate that.
Yeah, we don't want to dox anyone in this family. But
if you want their address,
yeah, Nick knows what he suggested. Yeah. And we are interested.
It's been on the docket for a while.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We just haven't slotted it in the calendar, but we do have plans to do this tuning company that does Fords.
And R&D. I mean, they make hardware too. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
I don't know.
But thank you for writing in, Nick, and we appreciate you listening every week. If you want to send in your own fan mail, send it to passgas@donutmedia.com. We'll read it on air, maybe. We'll take into consideration your suggestions and appreciate you guys listening.
Yeah.
Tell your friends, give us a 5-star review on Spotify or wherever you listen to the podcast.
It's been really great. Bart, again, Bart's here, man.
Thanks,
Bart's
guys.
On the pod. You did a great job once again. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow Bart at Bids Bardo. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. If you would like, big thanks to Edgar Grajeda and Audrey Holden holding it down.
Oh, nice. This is the first time we said that joke.
That is.
Nice. Oh. See you next week.
Bye.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.